to What She Said on 105.9 The Region. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. Spring continues to unfold all around us with grass greening and leaves bursting into life, and I can't help but feel it's a perfect time to embrace the energy of the season and dive into activities that rejuvenate our spirits. New fitness routines, more time with friends, and more learning. That's where What She Said comes in. This week's show is packed with diverse and impactful conversations that promise to enlighten and inspire. Here's what's coming up. First up, I'm joined by Anu George Kanjanathopoul, Executive Director of International Justice Mission Canada. Anu leads the charge against human trafficking and the online sexual exploitation of children. The realities and the geographic prevalence of these crimes will surprise you, and it's a discussion you need to hear. In entertainment, Anne Brody is back with her latest recommendations, including Elizabeth Moss's gripping performance in the new FX series, The Veil. We'll also discuss Nicolas Cage's role in Retirement Plan on Netflix, Rumor Willis in My Divorce Party, and the premiere of the four-part series Potluck Ladies. Alice McEwitt, a Toronto-based author celebrated for her poignant and humorous essays, joins me to talk about her debut collection, The Call is Coming from Inside the House. Exploring her identity as a queer woman and mother through the nostalgic lens of the 80s and 90s pop culture scene, Allison's work offers a unique perspective on personal growth and societal norms. We'll also explore the concept of right-sizing with Heather Lochner from Sotheby's International Realty Canada. Heather will provide valuable insights onto optimizing living spaces to fit your lifestyle, whether that involves moving to a smaller home or enhancing your current residence with smart technology. Finally, in celebration of Earth Month, Nancy Cottingham Powell, Executive Director of Blue Act Marine Society, will discuss the critical importance of marine conservation and the efforts to educate the public about sustaining BC's marine ecosystems. So tune in for an hour of engaging and meaningful discussions. Let's spring into action together right here on 105.9 The Region. He's picking up new vibrations. He's looking for sweet sensations. Ladies. Yeah. When the world has struck its part, when the world has dealt its cards, if the hand is hard, together we'll mend your heart. In today's first interview, I'm joined by Anu George Kanjanathopoul, CEO of International Justice Mission Canada, an organization at the forefront of the fight against human trafficking and the online sexual exploitation of children. Anu, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today about this deeply important issue.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me, Candace.
Could you start by telling us about the International Justice Mission Canada and the primary focus of your work?
Absolutely. International Justice Mission Canada is part of a global organization that protects people in poverty from violence. We are the largest anti-slavery organization in the world. We partner with the local authorities, and our presence is in over 40 offices in 27 countries to combat trafficking, violence against women and children, and other forms of abuse against people who are poor. IJM works with local authorities and governments to rescue and restore survivors, hold perpetrators accountable, and help strengthen public justice system so they can better protect people from violence.
I think we all sort of understand that online sexual exploitation of children is an increasing problem globally.
Yeah.
Could you explain, though, how this form of abuse typically unfolds and who are the main perpetrators?
Absolutely. To understand this, I would love to give a little bit of a background. I mean, earlier when we were working in the Philippines, in Cebu, we were looking at minors who were trafficked for sexual exploitation into these brothels. But then traffickers got very creative because we were cracking down these cases and reduced the prevalence of that crime to almost 80%, 79%. And the numbers kept getting better for the survivors and for the work that we were doing in the field. However, the creativity of the perpetrators extended because the stakes are high. There's a ton of money here. And they gently went into this online sexual exploitation of children, where children are sexually abused by traffickers who live stream the abuse to offenders from anywhere in the world, willing to pay and direct the sexual abuse from their own homes. Nearly 500,000 Filipino children, 1 in 100 children, were trafficked to produce new child sexual exploitation material just in the year 2022. And we had a scale of harm report, a study which was done in partnership with the Nottingham University. And we discovered that nearly 500,000 children were trafficked to produce new child sexual exploitation material. And nearly 250,000 adult Filipinos, or 3 out of every 1,000 adult Filipinos, traffic children to produce new child sexually explicit material. And traffickers are usually relatives or people known to the victim, but they were abused. These victims were abused between 2 months to 4 years, with an average duration of abuse being 2 years. And the average age of victims was only 11 years, with the youngest being 2 months old. And a two-month-old child was actually taken, extracted from the space. And we've even seen one-year-old children being abused. And 65% of the traffickers in Philippines were female. And the traffickers ranged in age between 15 to 76 years old. But the median age was 27. 97% of the traffickers were Filipino. But when we think about that crime from a Canadian perspective, in the list of the world's largest consumers of this crime, unfortunately, Canadian men rank fourth. We have been perpetuating this crime remotely, and there has been an investment of almost $900,000 into this crime by the Canadian population. So it is just unbelievable. Extent of abuse. Yeah.
This is why it was really important for me to have you on, because I think that people think that this is a far off crime in a distant land that has no impact. But the consumers, the people actually consuming this horrific content, I suppose, for lack of a better word, are Canadian men.
Yeah.
So what can we do about this?
So many things, really. One is to basically come to terms of fact. Like, people say, oh, it's not happening here. It's not happening in my backyard. It's probably happening in tens of thousands of basements. It's absolutely not something that we can push under the rug and pretend that is not a reality. So coming to awareness with this. Now, Canada's responsibility would be to make sure, how does this, according to the Filipino Anti-Money Laundering Council, since 2015, Canada has consistently been ranked as a top four source of online sexual abuse and exploitation material. But not only does this abuse traumatize children involving an exploitative act, evidence suggests that people who view such activity have an increased likelihood of wanting to seek out children for similar activities in their home countries. So 2 or 3 weeks ago, I saw this news report where a Canadian man was held accountable for, doing unthinkable things to children. It was in the news. If we were interested in digging this up, there is proof and evidence that the likelihood is that this person would have engaged in online sexual exploitation, because there is research that leads in that direction. There's this Finnish NGO Protect Children that found 40% of child sexual abuse offenders having sought contact with a child after viewing the material. So Canadians need to be concerned. It is not a problem that is happening outside of our country. It is a problem that is happening. Yes, the direction is happening here, but these individuals can cause harm to our children. According to Childlight, which is those reporting online sexual offending behaviors against children in Australia, the US, and the UK, also report being 2 to 3 times more likely to seek sexual contact with children between the ages of 10 to 12 years old if they were certain that nobody would find out. So this impacts Canadians, which also puts this burden of IGM Canada to seek Canadians to have this burden on what it is that we should be considering. One, the Canadian government should consult with survivors of child sexual abuse and exploitation online while developing legislation and regulation, including Filipino and other overseas survivors abused online by Canadians. It needs to be something that we Canadians and the Canadian government is investing time, energy, and money into, because these individuals, the survivors, have lived experience of abuse online and have an expertise to share to support a safer internet that protects children. So they need to be part of the conversation. And because Canadian offenders sexually abuse children in live streams to produce and consume and disseminate new child sexual abuse material, it is important that the Online Harms Act or future regulations consider this form of harm live streamed and the platforms it takes place on, and require the tech sector to seriously address this form of exploitation. And the third thing would be legislative and regulatory frameworks should incentivize companies to build tech platforms safe by design with a preventative approach to protect children from harm and disrupt offending. So we are continuing to study and monitor the progress of the bill. And we are also willing to participate in the development collaboration with our partners in Philippines and others. But this is so crucial as Canadians for us to, you know, keep bugging your legislators, your local MPs, and talk to them and find out why, you know, there is not much action being taken on this. I mean, that is how I'd say. And again, there was a recent Supreme Court ruling around IP addresses, and that has significantly impacted the way RCMP can address the crime. The ruling required police to have a warrant or a court order to obtain the numbers making up of a person's organization's IP address. So this has made it increasingly hard for law enforcement and justice officials, because some have argued that placing a reasonable expectation of privacy on an IP address alone upsets the careful balance of the Supreme Court that is stuck with Canadians' privacy interests and the needs of law enforcement. But I firmly believe IGM Canada's position is that these things can exist together. You know, if social media and mainstream outlets have been a buzz with the discussion of, you know, Government of Canada's proposed Online Harms Act, we can actually stand up and say, well, these things, internet freedom can coexist with child protection. And if anything, child protection should be supreme and sovereign over the other debates and discussions that we have, because this is important and urgent.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back to finish this discussion with Anu George Kanjanathopoul from Justice Mission Canada.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
We're back with Anu George Kanjanathopoul, CEO of International Justice Mission Canada. Anu, you've had a partnership, a 20-year partnership with Philippine law enforcement. Can you tell me about the impact it's had on combating child exploitation?
Absolutely. And this partnership that we have with, engaging in partnership with Philippines and having an RCMP officer posted there has been significant, because that is the only connection we have to kind of have someone who's communicating back and forth with the perpetrator who's here and the victims who are there. However, one of our many recommendations has been to increase the number of RCMP officers who are stationed out of Philippines. Other countries have managed to have at least two, but more, to ensure that the partnership between these two countries, to ensure that the crime is nipped in the bud, you know, even before this can happen. So our hope is that we can have more RCMP officers stationed out of Philippines to ensure that this crime is addressed properly.
And IGM is working with NGOs, governments, industries to improve detection, reporting, and international collaboration to combat this. So not just child exploitation, but you also cover a whole range of really important issues under IGM. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Our work is embedded in partnership. We partner with local justice systems around the world to build safe communities where all are protected from violence and slavery. And this is how we do it. We strengthen justice system. We partner with police, judges, community leaders to respond to the violence, then work together to make safe communities that last. Then we rescue and restore victims. We partner with local authorities to rescue victims of violence and restore survivors until they can thrive in freedom. And then we bring criminals to justice. We advocate for our clients in court until the people who are trafficked and abused, who traffic them and abuse them can no longer exploit or enslave or abuse another person again. And then we scale the demand for protection. We equip champions anywhere and everywhere to advocate for a safer and a more just world for everyone. And we do this, around the world. The work is on trafficking and slavery, violence against women and children. And right now, online sexual exploitation of children comes under the umbrella of trafficking and slavery. Violence against women and children is nearly one in five girls are sexually abused at least once in her life, and nearly 736 million women have experienced physical or sexual violence at least once in their lifetime. And we are dealing with statistics like this that is absolutely heartbreaking. So the work that we do in Latin America and Africa is extremely important. And our global impact has been we have relieved 21,800 people from sexual and domestic violence. This is specifically to our violence against women and children casework. And 2,800 women and children have been restored to safety and strength through IJM's aftercare program and partners since 2013. And 3,300 widows and orphans have returned to their homes since 2004. But if I were to talk about the overall impact of the organization, 90,000 people have been rescued from slavery around the world. And we have seen close to 11 million people protected. So the hope is that we can protect 500 million people by 2030. We are getting there, as long as we have the partnership of organizations and people who care about this, we are very well on our way to getting there, Candace.
Incredible. I can't thank you enough for joining me today. This has been incredibly enlightening. I want people to be able to connect with you, find out more about the work you do, and perhaps, throw their hat in the ring and help out. So where can they do that?
Well, www.ijm.ca to find out more about the organization. But I talk a lot about our casework and, apprise people about new cases and survivor stories on my Instagram handle. So that would be Seek Justice Now. And you can find me there and the IJM Canada website.
Thank you, Anu. Thank you for all of your hard work. Absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
It's time for Saturday Night at the Movies with Anne Brody. And this week, we're kicking things off with The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. And Elizabeth Moss, she just seems to pick winners after winners. Isn't she incredible?
Oh, my God. She has got a great agent. And this, I adore this series. It's really heavy duty. And it concerns two women. Elizabeth Moss is an intelligence officer and assassin. I just want to say it's an FX production on Disney Plus on April 30th. So anyway, she's an intelligence officer. Her job is to go to the Turkish-Syrian border and extract a prisoner, a woman who is known as the devil of ISIS. And apparently she's been a commandant and she's set up a number of massacres. Well, we don't know if any of this is true, but she's wanted by multiple global agencies. So Elizabeth has her hands full. And the thing about Elizabeth's character is that she enjoys life. Here she is trudging on foot across the desert in winter. And she likes people. She talks to people. She seems to get a kick out of things. And yet she's so strategic. She knows exactly what to do in any given circumstance. You admire the heck out of her. Wow. And the other woman too, she's very strong. Eventually, Moss's character gets her to London, where she's still not safe, but Moss has to stay in the Middle East in order to complete another mission. It's fantastic. I can't tell you how great it is. So everybody, please watch The Veil. Wow.
All right. Excellent. So it's our next big addiction. All right. Wonderful. I want to talk about Retirement Plan with Nick Cage, because Nick Cage is one of these guys, I love him or I hate him, depending, right? And so I think in this one, I'm going to love him.
I've interviewed him so many times over the years, and he's the funniest guy, and he's so out there. And he lands his jokes all the time. And he always dances. In every movie, he does a little dance.
I didn't know that.
So anyway, in this one, he plays the father of a girl who is wanted in an organized crime power play, which leaves her husband vulnerable to them. So Nick says, come down, stay with me in the Cayman Islands. So she does. And she brings a hard drive with her, unbeknownst to her. So this huge crime syndicate wants that hard drive. They find out that she's gone and she has it somehow. And so she goes and shows up at Nick Cage's house. And he's just being Nick Cage. He's nutty, out of control, eccentric, and extremely appealing. And I think you'll really like him in this. And turns out he has extraordinary skills in terms of self-defense and assassination. So who is he? It's fabulous. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Where can people catch that in?
On Netflix.
All right. Let's move on, because this one, obviously, I had a divorce party.
Oh, you did?
So I'm a big fan. I did. So I'm a big fan of them. And now there is a series, My Divorce Party.
Yeah. Well, Rumor Willis leads My Divorce Party, and she takes a group of her girlfriends out to the desert near Palm Springs, you know, for wild times and fun times. And the woman who just got divorced refuses to hand over her sizable fortune, or half of it at least, to her husband. So she brings it with her in bills, and her plan is to burn it on the bonfire. So you can imagine that throws everyone into disarray. So she throws a few on, and then they stop her. They go out bar hopping and have a great time and spend, spend, spend. And they decide that they need to buy something really good and really big and really useless in order to thoroughly enjoy her divorce. So it follows their adventures. They buy a $22,000 bottle of wine. I mean, you know, why not? Why not? So the repartee back and forth is fun. It's silly at times, but at other times it just really gets you. And I have to admire these ladies, because each of them is such an individual, well-defined character, all recognizable as girlfriends, and all also a group supporting the divorcee. So it's really fun. It's on digital and TVOD, and therefore available at home to watch.
Tell me we have about 30 seconds left. Tell me about Potluck Ladies.
I love it. It's the cutest series. It's about a phenomenon that happens, I guess, in Toronto. There are condos out in Mississauga. People buy lone wives and their kids, immigrants from the Middle East or Asia or whatever, because their husbands stay behind to make the big bucks, which they can't make here. And the women stay and establish a home in Canada. So they stick together like glue. It's really a nice group. And again, a lot of well-defined characters, all with their own, you know, shtick and whatever. And it goes through what happens to them when a journalist comes in and wants to do an interview on the condo women. Her article is taken. She spends a good deal of time with them and becomes friends with them. But her article is made to be far more sensational. So she lands in the soup with them. And then bit by bit, their struggles come out, their serious struggles. So it's not all laugh and fun. But I really enjoyed it. And there's a big emphasis on food, which is nice.
Okay. Where can people catch that?
That is on Hollywood Suite.
All right. Excellent. All right, Anne, thank you so much, and we will see you next week.
See you next week.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
It's hard to believe that you are at home by yourself when I just heard the voice or the voice of someone else. Just this question, why do you feel you gotta lie? Getting caught up in your game when you cannot say my name.
I'm thrilled to welcome Allison McCuitt, a Toronto-based author whose poignant and humorous writings has captured the hearts of many. Allison has graced pages from the New York Times to Broadview magazine with her insightful narratives. Her debut essay collection, The Call is Coming from Inside the House, explores her identity as a queer woman and a mother through the nostalgic lens of pop culture from the 80s and 90s. This collection is not just a reflection on personal growth and the societal pressures of normativity, but a journey through the intimate corridors of Allison's life, highlighting the intersections of culture, motherhood, and identity. Allison, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I'm thrilled to be here. I've listened to several episodes of your podcast, and I think it's marvelous. So,
oh, wonderful. So your book interlaces personal stories with 80s and 90s pop culture. So could you share how these cultural elements influence your sense of identity?
Yeah, the book goes through, it's organized into a series of tropes, really. So the babysitter, and there's the psycho chick, and all of these simplistic tropes that we give to the characters in scary movies or literature in general, really. So, you know, I wanted to explore that and, you know, talk about how we are more than just these simplistic tropes, binaries, labels that we're given and the things that we go by. You know, the world is very complex and our relationships are complex. Our identities are complex. Conflict, which we all go through in millions of different ways, you know, which is highlighted in scary movies and things like that. It's complex and difficult. And ideally, we would all be a little more gentle with each other and a little more open and understanding to journeys that we've all been through in our life, right? Everybody goes through difficult times. Everybody is raised with their own kind of traumas and prejudices and privileges and different kinds of oppressions and marginalization that we all go through. And, you know, that's kind of where I was coming from.
You've alluded to a couple of times, you've said scary and horror movies, and horror and motherhood are central themes in your essays, which makes me giggle a little bit. Any mother will say that, yes, it sometimes can be a horror. So what connections did you find between these experiences, and why did you choose to explore them together?
Well, my children are as far away from a horror show as you could ever imagine. They are wonderful, sweet, terrific kids, very easy to parent, and marvelous human beings who I just enjoy every minute with. The pregnancy part of motherhood, that was the difficult part. For me, I had a challenging journey that involved, by the end of it, I think it was 9 different surgeries, multiple miscarriages, 7 months on bed rest with one. And then in the other one with my other daughter, I was in and out of the hospital several times. It just seemed like every step of the way, there was another body horror awaiting me. And body horror is something that you see quite often in horror movies and in scary films and thrillers. And so obviously that part was quite linked, as well as, you know, I had the feeling or the instinct at the time that I was on bed rest in this Victorian home that we owned and were renovating that was potentially haunted. That was kind of like the lore in the neighborhood, and with some of the experiences that we had. You know, there's something quite gothic about that, being pregnant on bed rest in a home with the ghost of a mother, maybe, because that was the New York Times essay that I wrote before was about that experience of living with a mother who might be a ghost, or vice versa, I should say.
I do discuss overcoming the phantom, again, ghosts, but the phantom of traditional family structures in your writing. So what has this process involved, and how might your insights assist others navigating similar challenges?
Yeah, I think the essay that deals with that the most is probably the Haunted House essay. And what I talk about in that essay was that, you know, we had looked at several homes in our search for the perfect family home for us. And that when we go into a house and we purchase a home, there's a little piece of that family that came before you that you want to possess, right? So you go into this house and you get that nice, cozy feeling that this family has created. And then as you peel away the wallpaper and you rip up the floors and you find all of these little bits and pieces that they've left behind, these signs and symbols that they left behind that kind of show you who they are. It was interesting to me how we kind of carpeted over that piece of their life. And so that resonated with me quite a bit about this kind of heteronormative family that we were moving into their space, really, and what they had left behind us. And then our family kind of came to a close during that time after we had the children and our relationship structure changed and the divorce came. And, you know, my ex had wanted to build a home from the ground up. And so I kind of talk about, you know, maybe we weren't meant for that traditional heteronormative family space. Maybe we should have built something custom that was really just for us, something that would be unique to who we are as a queer couple that is, you know, yeah, it's it can be, not that there's dramatic differences between gay couples and straight couples. Love is love is love. And the same fights and, you know, issues that we had in our relationship, straight couples have in their relationship, communication, money, you know, different family squabbles that come up and, you know, your own dreams changing and reevaluating where you want to be in that 5-year, 10-year, 20-year. That's not unique to a gay couple or a straight couple. That's everybody. But there are moments that are unique and special to being in a queer relationship. There are unique struggles that come with that, to be recognized and, you know, to be, when we first got together, marriage wasn't legal. And then it was legal. And then it was maybe going to be taken away. And then even now, you know, when you look around, it's all potentially folding back in. And so there's that tenuousness that comes to your relationships as a queer couple that is different and does have a different level of stress attached to it. And so maybe instead of, we'd fought so hard to get married and to do all of these things, I had wanted all of these things, the dog, the backyard, the children, I had heavily participated in making sure our relationship was as traditional, I think, as I thought it was supposed to be, what I was supposed to want. And maybe that wasn't the best thing for us. Maybe we should have found something a little bit different.
So what's next for you then after this book? Because you had an essay adapted into a television episode. How has this influenced your perspective on storytelling and the themes you wish to explore in the future?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I mean, that was very thrilling. So I was part of the Modern Love multiverse. There's the column, there's a book series, there's a TV series. And now that TV series has gone global. And so I was very excited to be part of the first season of Modern Love Amsterdam. Now, it was a unique story that was inspired by my essay. So it's not if you're looking for something that is exactly that essay just put to screen, that's not it. But it was inspired by it and very exciting to be kind of a part of all of that. You know, I'm an essayist, and I think that's a unique, that's a genre in itself, right? To be able to write personal essays. And often it's like, well, now that you wrote the essays, are you going to move to fiction? Are you going to do television? Are you going to do, and it's like, I'm an essayist. So, you know, I have a new book of essays that I'm working on. Do I have fiction? Totally. Do I have screenplays? Of course, everybody does. And they're super exciting and I get carried away and fall in love with a new story every other day. But, you know, I've been writing personal essays since before I knew what they were. So I'll probably stick with that for a bit.
Amazing. Well, I can't wait to read the book. I just got my copy yesterday, so I didn't have an opportunity to read it yet. But I want people to be able to follow along with you and get their own copy. So where can they do that?
It's coming out on April 30th. The advanced reviews have been phenomenal. It's been listed on the Toronto Star top reads for spring. Autostraddle, which is a big site, gave it some terrific reviews, like mind-blowing review, actually. It's doing really well on Goodreads, which is great. Gosh, I appreciate all of those people. That's so wonderful that they read it and give their thoughts. But you can buy it anywhere right now. You can go online and pre-order it. Take a look at your independent booksellers, especially, you know, gotta love Glad Day Bookshop in Toronto and Type and all of these marvelous independent booksellers.
Okay, fantastic. And where can people find you online, Allison?
Thanks. I'm on Instagram at all Ally, Ally, and then another Ally. So at all Ally, Ally.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Allison.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to have been here.
In this interview, we're taking a look at the increasingly popular concept of right-sizing. This isn't just about downsizing. It's about finding the perfect fit for your lifestyle and needs, whether that's moving to a more manageable space or optimizing your current home with smart technology. Joining me today is Heather Lochner from the Burrell team at Sotheby's International Realty Canada. Heather specializes in helping clients navigate the choices that lead to finding their ideal living space. Today, she'll share expert insights on the reasons behind right-sizing, how to approach this transition effectively, and what features to look for in a new community. Heather, welcome, and thank you for helping us understand this really important trend.
Well, thank you for having me on board. It's great to be here, and I love that terminology, right-sizing, because it appeals to people who maybe have too much space, but it also appeals to people who maybe don't have enough space. And that can be for a variety of reasons.
And downsizing can sound a little depressing, to be honest.
Yeah,
and,
yes.
And right sizing actually feels welcoming for some reason. So can you explain what right sizing means exactly and how it differs from downsizing?
For sure. So at every stage in our life, we always need different types of homes. You're a first-time home buyer. You live alone. You don't need a 3,000, 4,000 square foot apartment or house. So maybe what's right for you at that time is a one-bedroom condo. And then maybe you start working from home. Hello, 2020. And suddenly that one bedroom, you need a 1+10, or you need a 2-bedroom. Or you find a partner. And then you have children or you adopt a dog and one bedroom is no longer going to cut it. You need more than 600 square feet. So right sizing in that case would be going from something smaller to something bigger. Again, if you want your parents to come live with you, I'm working with a client right now who she's having her senior parents come and move in with her. So they need more space. The flip side to that is, well, really what I'm facing at this point in my life, I've lived with two teenagers. One is off at college. The next one is leaving in a year and a half, hopefully, and they might not move back. And suddenly I have a 4-bedroom home, that I don't need anymore. So it's a lot of space. It's a lot of cleaning. and we want to make it a little bit smaller and a more manageable lifestyle for my husband and I. So we're going to right size to something smaller.
You've run through, I think, what I think are a lot of the common reasons people choose to right size their living arrangements. So how should someone determine the best size for their new home when considering right sizing?
I would say you start at the basics. You start with how many rooms do you need? Do you need a bedroom? Well, obviously you would like a bedroom over a studio, a kitchen. Do you need a separate dining room, or can you have a giant island and a little table that acts as a place to eat? Do you need an office? How many bedrooms would you like and can you afford at this point of your life? And then you start building it out from there. What size bed do you have? A lot of people don't take that into consideration and they see a beautiful condo or a home and the room is 10 by 10 and they've got a king size bed. That's never going to work. Also, you've got to think about when you enter a property. A lot of the new properties don't have front hall closets. And I don't know, I think I have about 20 different jackets. I love jackets. I need my front hall closet. I need storage space. So you start with what you need, and then you move to what you would like to have.
Yeah, there's no way I'm giving up my king size bed. There's just no way I can do it. So I'm going to need a big bedroom, Heather. I can tell you that much. So can you discuss, I think we would be remiss if we didn't discuss this, because the role of smart technology, because it's everywhere. And so how is that making smaller spaces more livable and efficient?
Well, that's something we're seeing more and more often. Especially in the condo market. So first and foremost, we're noticing it with security features. And a lot of the population really likes this. It's an extra added benefit that you use your smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, they always have fobs to access the elevator. You can't get out of the main floor without a special access through smart technology. Building on that comes light fixtures. So a lot of we're seeing in condos, mostly in condos, you see it in large homes as well. Everything can be controlled by your phone. So your lights, your laundry, my Instapot. And so what we're seeing is that way, being able to enter the home and not having all the lights off, that you can turn the lights on, gives most buyers that added sense of comfort. And then the other thing I have seen in some of these, what they call micro apartments, under 500 square feet, are beds that go up and down.
Like a Murphy bed.
Like a Murphy bed, but it's suspended from the ceiling.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Yeah. So you lift it up and underneath it is your workspace. So we're seeing a lot more of that through technology. That's kind of more at the higher end, where furniture rises and other furniture replaces it.
I feel like we're living in the Jetsons now. Like this is a whole new time in real estate. So what are some key features then? Because it's not just about the home. It's about the community you're in. So what are some key features to look for in a community when planning to right size your home?
There's usually three things that will dictate where you live. And usually two of those three are non-negotiable. So always budget. If budget isn't a problem, that's fabulous. Community is another one, and size. So looking at the community, you really want to take into account your lifestyle. Do you need to be close to transit? Do you want sidewalks? Because a lot of communities aren't built with sidewalks. Do you want a more senior community? So then you're looking at bungalows. You're looking at communities that have a large presence of bungalows. You're looking at accessibility to amenities. So your grocery stores, your, you know, drug stores. And from there, again, we build out the plan. Do you want a place, if you're in a condo, how important is outside green space, playgrounds? And then you're able to start narrowing your focus based on what your necessities are. And I have a client who has, it's his budget dictating. And then second to that is he needs to be in close proximity to transit as well, because he doesn't have a car and he doesn't drive. So along with transit, we need to be close to grocery stores. And that's really how we have focused where we're looking.
And, you know, you mentioned that right-sizing might mean finding a larger space. But for the most part, I feel like people will be looking for smaller spaces, which is challenging because now you have to figure out how to, what you're getting rid of. So any strategies, you know, that can help individuals adapt to a more compact living environment?
Yes. And that is start early. The moment you start thinking, hey, you know what, it might be time to start thinking about downsizing, that is when you have to start weeding through your stuff, because we all have those hidden crevices where, you know, report cards from when we were in grade one still exist. And that trophy for the most, you know, likable player, we've all held on to them. So first and foremost, start downsizing. Return all of those cookbooks that your mom gave you. Give them back to her or donate them and start getting rid of the extras that you have. Do you really need that memory from a trip you took? And because you don't know what your space is going to look like. So the best thing to do, even if you have different boxes, donate now, throw away, to be considered. And then you, at least you're starting early and it's not that mad frantic rush of putting everything you own into a box and then deciding once you get there. That's just too much stress for everybody.
Absolutely. Well, listen, my mom and dad are going through this process right now. Oh, so I feel like I could hire out my mother because she is ruthless with what she's getting rid of. There's nothing, no stone unturned. She is getting rid of everything. It's incredible to watch, you know, a lifetime of accumulating stuff and then we get rid of it.
Yes. I know. And it's hard. It's hard. But it's also cathartic, maybe.
Absolutely. Heather, this is great. I really like this concept of right sizing. It feels right, for lack of a better word. So I want people to be able to find out more and keep in touch with you. Where can they do that?
Oh, wow. I have a website. It is heatherlochner.com, and that's LOCHNER. So heatherlochner.com. You can also find me through the Sotheby's International Realty website. I'm on Instagram, Heather_Lochner. The Burrell team, Burelle. We have a presence on Facebook. All of those different ways, and reach out.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
For the final interview of April and Earth Month, we're diving into the importance of marine conservation and education. I'm thrilled to be joined by Nancy Cottingham Powell, Executive Director of Blue Act Marine Society, an organization committed to protecting BC's marine ecosystems and educating the public about ocean sustainability. Nancy, it's wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Candace.
Could you introduce us to Blue Act Marine Society and the role it plays in marine conservation and education in British Columbia?
Yes, I'd love to. So we just have gone through a rebrand. So some people might know us as Gibson's Marine Education Center Society, and we rebranded to Blue Act Marine Society this last year. And partly that was along with our aquarium that we run. We have a collective release aquarium in Gibson's, BC. That was the Nicholas Sontag Marine Education Center. It is now Tide Pools Aquarium, Nicholas Sontag Tide Pools Aquarium. And we kind of use the two roles of these, of the society and the aquarium, to help engage people in ocean awareness and help them understand the beauty and the wonder of our oceans through actually getting to see the creatures that live in that subtidal, intertidal area. Some of them a little deeper than that, but most of us can't put our diving gear and go down and see that. So this is a chance to get up close and personal and kind of understand the wonder of the beautiful, beautiful ocean that we have here. And from there, we engage people to understand what's going on within climate change and pollution issues and all those other factors that are affecting our oceans today. And then how can they help? So we're helping people step through that journey to make action more possible. And our conservation work ranges from everything from working with the town of Gibson's on our Healthy Harbor Project, which is doing eelgrass monitoring, because eelgrass is very important to a lot of ocean-based fish, but also the salmon runs that are coming in and out of the creeks. When those fry are come down from the creeks, they need some place to hide so that they can grow and eat and start to thrive before they go out into the deep ocean. And so that eelgrass sort of breakwater area, as it were, is essential for that and a lot of climate mitigation as well. So we do work with the town of Gibson's on that. We're doing marine debris cleanup, both out of the marine zones and also on the shoreline. I'm working with partners like Ocean Legacies Fund and Foundation and people like that. And then we've got a new partnership coming up with Marine Coast Conservation Society. They've got a hydrophone system around the West Coast that they've hooked into. They call it Noise Tracker. And you get to listen to what's going on under the ocean. Good and bad, right? We're going to get to hear marine mammals and all sorts of things, you know, doing their thing. But we're also going to understand the impacts of marine traffic on, you know, whales being able to hear each other and interact and do the things that they do. So it's going to be a great educational tool, and we're calling it the Marine Coast Ocean Listening Station, and it will launch June 8th for World Oceans Day.
So how did the Blue Act Marine Society mark Earth Month, and what are some of the key messages you hope to impart through your campaigns and activities all year long?
Well, the rebrand was the beginning of our Earth Month journey, and then we do have this June 8th, which is World Oceans Day, which kind of marks the end of that month, that we'll sort of celebrate what's going on in the whole ocean and opening up this whole new portal to listening to underneath the ocean. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about marine traffic in our region and the effects that it's going to have on everything from glass sponge reefs to the whale migration, all sorts of things. So we're really interested to share that story with our community and bring that awareness level up so that maybe people can get involved with helping make change there. But there's also, we have a video that we've been working on with the Squamish Nation for a couple of years now. COVID kind of delayed a bunch of things on their relationship to the local region. And we're quite excited. We're hoping that it'll be ready for the June 8th launch as well.
Okay. And beyond that, are there any other upcoming projects or initiatives that you're excited about?
Well, so we're starting, there's a group of people that are starting Gibson's Ocean Fest. This is sort of taking the place of what was the beloved Sea Cavalcade for, I think, 50 years in this community, and it just kind of went away just before COVID. And so this is, the idea is bringing back a community celebration in July, so July 13th and 14th, with water sports and all sorts of fun things to do, hopefully concerts on the beach, on the dock, and all sorts of different things going on. They're just in the planning stages. And we're going to do a conservation day where we're going to bring our partners together on July 14th here at the Gibson's Public Market and sort of mark what we are doing, the good work that's being done, everything from kelp restoration and, you know, pods, which is opening, building a big facility up in Pender Harbor area, has got a lot of storytelling to do. We've got Rain Coast. We've got the other partners that I mentioned, the DFO, that's doing great work with salmon enhancement in the area and education within the schools that we partner with them on. So there's all these great stories, and we just want people to see all the good work that's going on and have an opportunity to maybe talk to people and even maybe sign up and volunteer for some of these good initiatives.
Amazing. I'm with you. I want people to do that too, Nancy. So where can they go to find out more?
So we have two websites now. One is called blueact.org, and that is the society's website where we kind of have our conservation work highlighted. And then we've got tidepoolsaquarium.org. And that is sort of more about the aquarium and the wonders and the local ocean. But that has a lot of our education opportunities sitting there as well, because we do have kid camps. We have all sorts of things that are available to people. You know, a lot of people like to come to the coast and register their kids for a camp in the summer, and then they can go off and do, I don't know, play golf or whatever they want to do. And our kids get to hang out with us during the day and learn more about their local oceans.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nancy.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Candace.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with our newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com, and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson on Apple and Spotify to catch past episodes and extended podcasts. I'll be back next week with another What She Said on 105.9 The Region.
Previous episodes of What She Said on 105.9theregion.com.